In this session, we're going to be looking at godliness in marital situations, 1 Corinthians chapter 7. This is the teaching that Paul gave us. And in verses 1 through 24, he speaks concerning those who are already married. In verses 1 to 9, he gives the pros and cons of marriage. And in particular, verse 1 and 2, sexual sin must be avoided. Now there's an introductory statement referring to their question. He says, "Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband." Now this terminology, "it is good for a man to not touch a woman," that means to have sexual relations with. And incidentally, that's despite the NIV, which translates that as marry. It doesn't specifically say marry. It's literally, "it's good for a man to not touch a woman." This corresponds to Proverbs 6:29, touching a neighbor's wife, and also Genesis 20, verse 9. I might make a comment here, and that is this entire verse may be a statement of the Corinthian position, where they denigrated the body and claimed that there should be no sex even within marriage, and Christians should divorce unbelieving spouses. But the distinction of terms here, not touching a woman, relates to the sensual aspect, speaking generally, including the unmarried. Now notice that the subsequent discussion that Paul has there, it proves that he is not saying it is good for the married man to not touch his wife. Now notice the part that follows. "However, because of sexual temptation, let each man have his own wife and each woman her own husband." The terminology "to have a wife" or "to have a woman" doesn't mean to marry. It can mean be married or to have sexually. And that is the obvious meaning in Isaiah 13, verse 16. The proof in context is 1 Corinthians 5, verse 1. "A man have his father's wife." Doesn't mean he married her. It meant he had her sexually. And here it is used as a command to have sexual relationships with one's own spouse. Incidentally, that shows that the sexual relationship is an intrinsic part of marriage. It is not just for procreation, and it's honorable. Hebrews 13, verse 4. Each is having his own spouse. It's clearly talking about a monogamous marriage. Then in verses 3 to 6, mutual sexual blessing is to be practiced in marriage. There is a mutual fulfillment of responsibilities in verse 3, and a mutual relinquishment of personal authority. And again, I'll comment here that the NIV, I think, is misleading. The NIV reads like this, quote, "The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife." End of quote. Now, it may be that that statement is true, but that is not what the text says. The text is relinquishing your authority to your spouse. Verses 5 and 6, consenting to abstinence for special prayer. And notice that depriving one another is based on the fulfillment of three conditions: mutual consent, temporary, and special focus on fasting and prayer. And in verse 6, Paul's concession is in regard to the immediately preceding. He is not commanding that people abstain from sexual relations so that they can pray effectively. Verses 7 to 9, marriage is optional. Paul says, I could wish that all men were like myself and had the flexibility of singlehood. But God gives different gifts to different people. He says in verse 8, it's good for single people to remain single. And it's possible here the focus is on the unmarried and then to widows in particular who might think that their station in life was particularly undesirable. But verse 9, if desire is too strong, it is better to marry. You know, the Corinthians were especially tempted to be immoral, and in our day, our society is rampant with temptations that arouse sexual passion. Then verses 10 to 16, saints are prohibited from causing separation. I should give you a little bit about Paul's background. Apparently, the president of the Sanhedrin was a descendant of Hillel. Remember, Hillel was the rabbi who had the liberal idea that you could divorce your wife for anything that you didn't like. If she burnt the food, or if she talked too loud, or if she did this or that, just get rid of her. Even if you found some other lady who had a prettier face. And Gamaliel was apparently a grandson of Hillel. And you remember, Paul was a student of Gamaliel. So Paul would have been steeped in the teaching of a liberal. And it's clear that Paul opposed his earlier liberal background. Now, there's a very interesting statement here. It says, "Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord." That's verse 10. And then verse 12, he says, "But to the rest I, not the Lord, say." There's a little bracket in there of verses 10 and 11. What is he talking about? It's not that some of what Paul says is authoritative and some of it isn't. What he's doing in those two verses, he's referring to Christ's teaching during his earthly ministry. In other words, Paul is saying, this is what Christ said, verse 10 and 11. Then when he gets to verse 12 and following, he's addressing issues that Christ did not address in his earthly ministry. Because in verse 12 and following, he's talking about what happens if you have a mixed marriage. What do you do? And Jesus wasn't addressing that. Notice that Paul wrote this material before the gospel autographs were written. According to an introduction to the New Testament, which I have, Matthew was probably written about AD 66 to 68, Mark 64 to 65, Luke 66 to 67, and 1 Corinthians was written 57. So evidently, Paul understood Christ's teaching on earth through conversations with the apostles, not from reading the gospels. Verses 10 to 11, he explains Jesus' teaching. He's explaining what Jesus' teaching means in other words. And the main point is, departure is forbidden. He says, a wife is not to depart from her husband. And verse 11, the last part, a husband is not to divorce his wife. And that corresponds to Christ's main point in the Gospels. Now the sub-point, only two options if departure occurs. To remain unmarried, and that's terminology that suggests divorce has occurred, or be reconciled to your husband. That implies he still has one. Now, when Paul says, but if she depart, that does not say it is okay if she departs, go ahead and remarry. He's saying if she depart, then either remain unmarried or be reconciled. And it's not saying she should depart. Paul is recognizing that sometimes departure occurs. Notice also he does not say, remain unmarried in order to be reconciled. As if you get to a stage where reconciliation is absolutely impossible, for example, let's suppose this husband marries someone else, then you're free to remarry. He's saying, remain unmarried or be reconciled, not remain unmarried in order to be reconciled. Notice that Paul is speaking in the context of a culture that allowed remarriage after divorce, and yet he clearly prohibits remarriage. This is a very significant pair of verses, verse 10 and 11, because Paul is explicitly explaining Jesus' teaching using different words. And he's not giving additional exceptions for drunkenness and abuse and desertion. He's saying, this is what Jesus taught. If she depart, then let her remain unmarried or let her be reconciled. Verse 11 is explicit proof that the innocent wife does not have the right to remarry. Now, why is reconciliation or remaining single so important? Because it will sober many couples into working on their troubled marriage so that marriage will not only survive, but it will also be a blessing to both. And if the church wickedly opens the door to remarriage, many couples will take that as their option rather than calling for God's grace to enable them to solve their problems. You see, it's easier to separate than to forgive and to bless and to love the person that has hurt you so many times and even fails again. But in the long run, it's harder. Some of you might enjoy reading a book by Diane Medved, M-E-D-V-E-D, called The Case Against Divorce. And She is not writing from a Christian perspective. She was a psychologist. She's divorced herself. And she decided to write a book on, if you have a bad marriage, get out of it and get on with your life. And so she started doing case studies to prove her point. You know what? The more she dug into those case studies, the more she saw how terrible it was. The more she realized if these people had worked as hard on their first marriage as they worked to deal with alimony and with child custody and with this and with that and with something else, plus a new marriage besides, they could have had the other marriage work in the first place. And so she ended up writing a book called The Case Against Divorce. You know what that is? That is wisdom shouting in the streets. In other words, look at life. Life shows you that divorce is a foolish option. Notice as you go on down through the passage, the husband is not to put away his wife. And then verses 12 to 16, he teaches on what is called mixed marriage. What if you have one spouse who's a believer and one who is not? For example, that's a case where you would have, like, you have two unbelievers that are married, and then one gets converted. What then? And Paul is not saying that this teaching is not authoritative as an apostle. He's just saying he is not quoting from the Lord's specific ministry while he was here on this earth. You know, if Paul's pronouncements were uninspired, it would be presumptuous for him to include verse 17 where he says, "And so I ordain in all the churches." And it would also be strange to see his comments in verses 25 and 40, in particular chapter 14, verse 37, where he says this, "If anyone thinks himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him acknowledge that the things which I write to you are the commandments of the Lord." The difficulty is when a spouse becomes a believer. I mean, both had been in unity on their evil, idolatrous practices, and now one becomes a believer, and there's not peace, there's a sword, and there's light dwelling with darkness, good dwelling with evil. You can imagine the tension that happens. You know what Paul's answer is to a difficult marriage with spiritual incompatibility? After all, can light dwell with darkness? If your spouse is willing to live with you, you stay with them. That's his answer. This marriage of a believer and an unbeliever is a valid marriage. You know what that is? A strong statement regarding the sacredness of the marriage bond. And if movement from darkness to light, one spouse becoming a believer, does not mean breaking off of this marriage relationship, the gulf between faith and unbelief is not sufficient ground for dissolving the marriage. And so other supposed incompatibilities wouldn't be either. Paul's frequent reference to Jesus' words shows his harmony with Christ in these matters. A believer is not to divorce an unbelieving spouse who is willing to continue the relationship. And incidentally, this material is conclusive proof that conversion has nothing to do with whether you're married or not. So many people want to say, well, this happened before my conversion. That is totally irrelevant as far as to whether you're married to a person or not. A Muslim is either married or not. An animist is either married or not. A pagan is either married or not. A Jew is either married or not. A Christian is either married or not. It has nothing to do with conversion date. Remember, marriage is an institution God gave to all of humanity, not an institution just for the church. Verse 14, the believer sanctifies the marriage even though the spouse is an unbeliever. It's not merely that the unbeliever is brought under a sanctifying influence, even though that is true. And it's not that this unbeliever is made inwardly holy. Rather, sanctification also has the idea of being set apart. And so this unbeliever is set apart, just like the temple is set apart, and its gold was special, and the altar is set apart. You know, it's not that the lamb and the gold are inwardly changed. The pagan husband is set apart for God's service. How? Because he's taken care of God's child, who is his wife. And he's taken care of her children. And so he is set apart in that special way. Now, verse 15. If the unbeliever departs, don't insist on maintaining the relationship. You know, in the Roman law, in the Greco-Roman world, a woman could readily divorce by demanding her dowry back, apparently. And if the husband refused, he had to pay 18% interest until he complied. And so the Christian approach would not be to withhold dowry in hopes of saving marriage. Now, what does this not bound mean? There's lots of debate on this. Notice it does not say you are not bound to your mate. It does say the believer is not under bondage, and that is a vast difference. There are two different words. In a great marriage, a man is bound to his wife, but he is not under bondage. He's not enslaved to his wife. And so this difference in wording does not support this false conclusion that so many people want, and that is that they have the right to remarry. It's also refuted by the context. Verse 11, if there was a separation, the only options are singleness or reconciliation. And the way a lot of people like to interpret verse 15 is that it would allow for remarriage. So what does this release refer to? It does not refer to the release from the marriage bond as Luther taught. Instead, it's the release from the bondage of the rule just given not to separate. The believer and the deserting spouse are still bound in marriage, but the believer is not under bondage to insist on this unbelieving person to stay with them. And that's confirmed by the following statement. God has called us to peace. If remarriage was what was in view, you would expect him to say that God would allow you to remarry. Now, how do you live when a spouse departs? God has called us to peace. In other words, the believer is not under bondage to absolutely and determinedly insist on hunting down the departing spouse and not trying to say, I've got to fulfill all these marriage obligations to the spouse who doesn't want it. God has called us to live peaceably in the midst of such circumstances. And so you can accept with peace of heart and will and emotions that your marriage is shattered and your conscience is free, not frantically trying to get him back. God has permitted this for you, and so you walk according to that calling. And how could that be done? It can only be done through supernatural power and grace. Verse 15, desertion is not a ground for divorce because you cannot understand this in a way that contradicts Paul's prohibition of a believer divorcing an unbelieving spouse. The primary action here is the departure of the unbeliever, and the secondary action is the passive response of the believer to that situation. You know, it's just so foolish to try to use this text to justify divorce and remarriage, because elsewhere the scripture speaks only of porneia as grounds for divorce, and we can't have Paul contradicting his earlier statement there in verse 11, and also there in verse 39, whereas death is the grounds for remarriage. So, verse 16, always look for a means by which you can be a channel to save your unbelieving spouse. Isn't it interesting that even if desertion occurs, this verse still speaks of them as husband and wife? And also, this emphasis shows there in verse 16 that verse 15 does not mean the freedom to go out and totally erect a great barrier to the relationship by marrying someone else. I mean, the goal is to what? Be the source, or the channel, rather, of salvation to your spouse. Verses 17 to 24 remain in your calling. How important is this? Repeated emphasis, verse 17, verse 20 and 24. And the teaching is for all the churches, not just some local situation there in verse 17b. He gives the example of circumcision in verse 17 to 19. Walk in the calling that God has distributed to you. Your particular background was given to you by God. And so live the life that God was assigned to you. Walk in this, knowing that he brings all things together for good. And so don't make an attempt to repudiate your background. Circumcision or lack of circumcision has nothing to do with the commandments of God in the New Testament. Verse 19, your background isn't important. What really matters is keeping God's commandments. Then he gives the example of slavery, verses 20 to 23. Remain in the calling you had when God called you, verse 20. Don't make an attempt to repudiate your occupation. If you were called as a slave, keep being a slave. But if you have an opportunity for freedom, use it. But he's saying physical slavery or freedom is irrelevant. I mean, it's so great what Christ has done. Isn't that amazing? That physical slavery or freedom is basically irrelevant. And that's an interesting point for those who claim that difficult circumstances in marriage are utter bondage. You need to get out of there so you can get on with your life. The Christian, verse 23, is to be a slave of Christ, not of men. And whenever our focus is on changing our circumstances rather than being a slave of Christ, we become slaves of men. Have you noticed that in your life? If you're focused on changing your circumstances, then you end up having to focus off of Christ onto being a slave of men. All callings must focus on fellowship with God. Verse 24, remain with God in fellowship in that calling. Now you're to maximize fellowship with God. If you're supposed to be in fellowship with God, that cannot happen if you're involved in unholy activities. You have to walk righteously, verse 17, in whatever circumstances God has placed you in. If you're in a difficult marriage, then you walk and love like Christ loves. If one is already divorced, then refuse to compromise Christ by marrying someone else. And the emphasis is maximize God's placement rather than hunting for new circumstances. The key to understanding this is don't make any changes upon conversion unless you are involved in sinful behavior. We've got to connect this paragraph back to verse 19, where Paul emphasizes the importance of keeping the commandments of God and the importance of abiding in God and being in fellowship with Him, verse 24. Now, sometimes people object to this, and they say, well, see, those who are divorced and remarried should simply continue in that marital state of their conversion. They should just stay as they're called. Do you notice divorce and remarriage are not mentioned here? And therefore, if you're to stay in your calling in which you were called, then it must refer to all kinds of marital states, if that's the case. And therefore, that would imply that no one could marry after they got converted. You follow that? Do you see how when people are hunting for a loophole, then they give you this fine-sounding argument that sounds plausible, but they say, all right, let's try it out. And when you try it out, it's nonsense. The meaning must be, do not sever any legitimate marriage. And that fits the preceding context in verses 12 and 13. You know, obviously, Paul is not saying, well, stay in the sinful state in which you were called. For example, if you were a murderer, just keep on murdering. Or if you're a prostitute, just keep on being a prostitute. Or if you're homosexual, just keep on being a homosexual. Why? Sin is never a calling. God is always calling us to depart from iniquity. And God never has a calling to remain in adultery. Now, verses 25 to 40, he speaks concerning virgins. Do you notice he's making a shift in his discussion? He says, now concerning virgins. So, that's talking about people who are not married. That verse naturally divides the chapter into two sections. The first section says, now concerning the things of which you wrote to me. And then, now concerning virgins. I think that the instructions for those already married or widowed, verses 1 to 24, and then verses 25 are and following are for those who are virgins. Notice Paul is giving advice, not commands, verse 25. In verses 10 to 11, there is direct reference to Christ's earthly teaching. Verses 12 to 24, there's an apostolic authority on issues not particularly addressed by Christ. And then verse 25 and following, this is something that comes from one whom the Lord has made trustworthy. You know, saints should value highly simple advice that spiritual men can give them. Now, there's some difficulties in this passage, and I'm not going to go into all of those. The word bound is the Greek word didesai, and there are reasons that sometimes people give why a divorced person could have permission to remarry, and I believe that they are not valid here in this passage for the following reasons, and that is, number one, it's contrary to the context of the paragraph, and the context of the paragraph is virgins. And the Greek word loosed, verse 27, it's not the word that Paul uses for divorce in the earlier part of the chapter. And according to a standard Greek lexicon, Arnton Gingrich, if you want to look that up, page 483, the word luo does not necessarily imply that the person was previously married. And, of course, if you allowed for the remarriage of divorcees, you would be back to contradicting verse 11. Do you see how, if you look carefully, a passage itself has internal characteristics that shows you when things are false? Clearly, you have the same person referred to in verse 28a as in 27b. And if this would be allowing a divorcee to marry, it would flatly contradict verse 11. I think it's better to see this part as a single man engaged to a virgin. For example, then in verses 27 to 28, remember that the Greek word for wife and woman is the same word. Gune can be either translated wife or woman, sort of like the German word Frau can mean either wife or woman. And so you could translate verses 27 to 28 this way, and I think it is better in light of verse 25 where he says, now concerning virgins. Are you engaged to a woman? Do not seek to be loosed from engagement. Are you free from a woman? Not engaged? Do not seek a woman. But if you marry, go beyond engagement to marriage. In contrast to Paul's advice, you have not sinned. I'm not saying that's a translation. I'm just trying to give you the flavor of how the word gune could be translated either woman or wife. And since we're talking about virgins here, I think that fits better. Verses 26 to 35, he has the advantages of singlehood. Marriage brings extra difficulties in times of distress. You know, if you were in a persecution context, it would be very unhandy to be married. Marriage is temporary, verses 29 to 31. Foregoing marriage will not be a detriment to your eternal interests. Verses 32 to 35, the unmarried person can focus more devotedly on the Lord. And it talks about being holy in body and spirit, verse 34. And then Paul is not restricting their liberty, verse 35. There's no moral obligation for singlehood, but he's desiring that nothing distract them from serving the Lord. And then he gives advice concerning marriage in verses 36 to 38. There's debate on this subject, whether it's talking about a man regarding someone he's engaged to, or whether it's talking about a father saying whether his daughter should get married. I'm not going to really go into that. The point I want to really notice is down there at the end where it says, verse 39, a wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives, but if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes, only in the Lord. Now notice there in verses 39 and 40, marriage is binding as long as the spouse lives. In case you were sidetracked, this is the conclusion. In other words, if it doesn't line up with verse 11 and verse 39, it's a wrong view. The death of the spouse is what makes remarriage legitimate. And it's terminology that is noticeably absent in the earlier part of the chapter. Widows are free to marry another believer. A special blessing, verse 40, or happiness by remaining single after the death of a spouse. Apparently, this is referring to older widows, because remember, Paul gave advice in another place for the younger widows to marry. This would be a revolutionary idea today. And likely Paul, as a rabbi, had been married and was now likely widowed. Now, modern explanation of this passage is a contrast to earlier exegesis of 1 Corinthians 7. I want to just read you a quote from the International Bible Encyclopedia, the edition that was copyrighted in 1935 and 1956, which is fairly recently. Listen to this, quote, Paul is the only other New Testament author besides Christ who has been supposed to treat of divorce, but a careful examination of Paul's writing will disclose the fact that he has nowhere discussed the question. For what cause or causes a man might put away his wife or a woman her husband with liberty of marriage to another person? If Paul has treated of divorce at all, it is in 1 Corinthians 7. But even a careless reading of that chapter will disclose the fact that Paul is not discussing the question of what causes marriage might be disrupted, but the question of manners and morals in the relation. Paul has not modified Christ in any respect. It has been supposed that in 7:15, Paul has allowed divorce to a believing partner who has been deserted by one unbelieving, and so he has been sometimes understood as adding desertion to the exception Christ made as cause for divorce. But Paul has not said in that verse or anywhere else that a Christian partner deserted by a heathen may be married to someone else. All he said is, if the unbelieving departeth, let him depart. The brother or sister is not under bondage, dedulatai, in such cases, but God hath called us in peace. To say that his deserted partner hath not been enslaved is not to say that he or she may be remarried. What is meant is easily inferred from the spirit that dominates the whole chapter, and that is, everyone shall accept the situation in which God has called him, just as he is. Be quiet is a direction that hovers over every situation. If you are married, so remain. If unmarried, so remain. If an unbelieving partner deserts, let him or her desert. So remain. God has called us in peace. Nothing can be more beautiful to the morals of the marriage relation than the direction given by Paul in this chapter for the conduct of all parties in marriage in all trials. Then he goes on to say something about remedies for marriage ills. In all civilized countries, the machinery of legislation and law can always be open for removal or relief of troubles in marriage without proceeding to its annulment. If a father is cruel to his children, we do not abolish the parental relation, but punish the father for his cruelty. If he deserts his children, we need not assist him to rear other children whom he can desert in turn, but we can punish him for his desertion. What can be done by law in case of parent and child can be done in case of husband and wife. By putting in absolute divorce, frequently for guilty and innocent alike, we invite the very evils we seek to cure. We make it in the interest of the dissatisfied party to create a situation that a court will regard as intolerable, and so he or she may go free. Then, by affording an easy way out of the troubles of married life, we are inviting carelessness about entering marriage. We say by divorce statutes to a young woman, if your husband deserts you, you may have another. If he is cruel, you may have another. If he fails to support you, you may have another. If he is drunken, you may have another. If he is incompatible or makes you unhappy, you may have another. And yet others beyond these. When an easy road thus made out of marriage, will there be proper caution about entering into marriage? By just as much as a crevice for relief of the miseries of married life is opened by divorce, by so much the floodgates are opened into these miseries. The more solemnly society is impressed that the door of marriage does not swing outward as well as inward, the more of happiness and blessing will it find in the institution. End of quote. And I just thought you might find it interesting that back in the 50s, there was a book published that was saying those kind of things. It shows how far Christendom has slipped just in the last few years. Well, what about marriage requirements for elders? You can turn to 1 Timothy 3. And this is the passage where it talks about the requirements for elders. What are the qualifications? And you notice that the marriage requirement for elders, its importance is emphasized by it being the first specific requirement on the list. The specific terminology is that he must be a one-woman man. Now, that's literally translating from Greek. He must be a one-woman man. And the word gune means either woman or wife, as I mentioned, depending on the context. And we have the exact analogous expression regarding widows in 1 Timothy 5:9, where she must be a one-man woman if she is to be taken in on the church rolls. Now, what are the possible meanings of this one-woman man? Well, one possible meaning is something the Catholics taught, and that is that he is married to the church. That was a Catholic attempt to promote celibacy. I think that's pretty easy to reject that one. Another possibility is that it's a prohibition of polygamy. The assumption is that there were men who were polygamists, and they were in the church, but if you're a polygamist, you can be in full fellowship, but then you couldn't be an elder. How do we deal with that? Well, first of all, there is no historical evidence of any polygamists entering the church at this time. Sometimes people want to use this argument regarding missions, but you cannot find any evidence anywhere that any polygamist ever entered the early church. You can look for it all you want. One of the reasons for that is polygamy was practically not practiced in the first century. It was forbidden in the Roman Empire at that time, but practiced by some. In other words, it was illegal in the Roman world, virtually unknown among the Jews. Herod was despised for his multiple wives. It was theoretically discussed by the rabbis, and it was condemned by Christian authors. And there's no evidence that any polygamist entered the church during the time of the writing of Timothy or Titus. I think it's important to put the burden of proof on the people who argue about these things. You see, they're making an argument from silence. They're assuming a one-woman man means he wasn't a polygamist. That's just an assumption. If they want to make a point, they should bring their evidence. They should bring at least one scrap of evidence of at least one polygamist that was part of the church during that time in the first century. And so if somebody brings you this argument, ask them to show you a citation. Under such conditions, it would be very strange for the Apostle Paul to make as the first requirement for an elder that he wouldn't be a polygamist. It'd be sort of like saying, now, if you're going to choose an elder in this fellowship, he mustn't be a Baal worshiper. But there's a clear refutation of this view, and that is 1 Timothy 5, verse 9. Because the exact analogous expression in reverse is given. If a widow is going to be taken into the church role, she must be a one-man woman. Now notice this. She's a widow right now, so she has no husband. So she must be a one-man woman. But if a one-woman man means not a polygamist, then one-man woman would be what? A woman who was not the type of woman in the fellowship that had about five husbands at once. That kind of procedure, that has happened in world history. It's rare, but there are places where women have multiple husbands. There's no evidence of that in either Jewish or pagan circles in the first century in the region where these letters were going. So I think we can reject that one pretty clearly. Second possibility is it prohibits a remarried widower from being an elder. Now, there's some arguments that people give for this, that both pagan and Jewish culture admired those who remained single after their spouse died. You have some of the same teaching in the early church. And so the idea is that ordinary Christians could get married after a spouse's death, but there was a higher standard for leaders. After all, the Old Testament high priest could not marry a widow. Again, as we deal with this, the priestly argument is invalid because it was the Old Testament high priest that couldn't marry a widow, and the high priest corresponds in the New Testament era to whom? Jesus. But the ordinary priests, which would correspond to Christians, they could marry widows. They were restricted from marrying divorcees, which again I think is interesting. This conflicts with New Testament teaching on marriage, which never depicts a legitimate second marriage as morally questionable. You can look as a reference Romans 7, 1-3. And the second legitimate marriage does not show moral weakness any more than the first did. But again, you have a conclusive refutation by this parallel with this one-man woman, widow eligibility for church support in chapter 5, verse 9. You know, clearly this is a historical reference since she has no husband at the present. She's a widow. And Paul commands the younger widows to marry. If they obeyed and married, then were widowed, their obedience at the earlier stage would disqualify them from church support in their old age. And it would be very strange that this was a only moral requirement for overseers. Well, here's another possibility. If he must be a one-woman man, it excludes the unmarried. And people are taking this as being the husband of a wife. You see, it doesn't deal properly with the force of the term one. If Paul wanted this meaning, he should have just eliminated the word one and said he has to be a husband of a wife. And furthermore, if this were the correct view, then in verse 4, a married man who is childless would be disqualified as well. Paul himself was an elder. You can read 1 Timothy 4:14 and 2 Timothy 1:6, but was not married. And Paul's admonition that one can serve the Lord better without distraction by being single, 1 Corinthians 7:32, would be contradicted by making marriage a requirement for eldership. So I think that one won't work too well. Another view is that this is referring to no history of divorce even before conversion. Now, the reasons for this view are, in this era, many Jews and Romans were divorced. And you know, when you have divorce, you're going to have marriage tangles that result from that. And these marriage tangles result in a violation of blamelessness. And we know that God's moral requirements apply not only to the church, but also to all of society. But remember, if you make requirements extend to pre-conversion days regarding marriage, you're going to also have to make requirements extend to pre-conversion days regarding the other things in the list. For example, the elder must not be one who's involved in drunkenness or a brawler, quarrelsome, greedy for money, household in chaos. And there are plenty of unbelievers who have that. What if they get converted and get their life straightened out and quit being a drunkard and quit having a household that's in chaos and quit being fighty and quit being greedy for money? Are they disqualified? If you say prior marriage situations before conversion disqualify the elder, then you're going to have to say it for those things too. So, I don't think that's the right view. I think it's best to take this in its literal Greek sense. He must be a one-woman man. Now, remember, these qualifications emphasize character. These qualifications are God's standards for all believers. It's not saying that all kinds of defects are fine for ordinary Christians, but the leaders can't have these defects. It's not saying that it's fine to have inappropriately married people in the midst of the congregation, but the leader can't be inappropriately married. It's not saying that you can have a bunch of drunken sots here among the laity, but the leader can't be given to much wine. You know, God does expect elders to be leaders. He expects them to be leaders in terms of personal spiritual attainment. He expects them to be leaders in terms of exemplary life for others to follow. And in selecting an elder, you want somebody who's not struggling in these areas. You see, the key is repentance and present abstinence from sin and entanglements. Now, correspondence with chapter 5, verse 9 suggests a connection with history in addition to present experience. So who is disqualified by this one-woman-man limitation? I believe here are the following. One would be a man who's flirtatious. You know, there's this man. He loves to talk to the ladies in the fellowship. Oh, he just loves to go over and talk to the ladies. And he loves to put a hand on their shoulder, you know, when he's talking to them and when he encourages her. He loves to do that. You know what? That man is not a one-woman man. And he shouldn't be selected as an elder. Or a man who struggles with pornography. Even if he realizes it's wrong and he's grieved by it and he still struggles to overcome it. You know, that kind of man is not content with his wife. He's not elder material. Or a man who has additional responsibility regarding past marriages. For example, if a polygamist has put away wives he had no right to, and then he needs to support these other wives, what's he going to have to do? He's going to have to be something different from a one-woman man. He lives with the one wife he's supposed to have, and he has to deal with all these other ones. Or a man with a history of divorce. He has alimony payments to make, and he has child custody interactions with, who knows, one, two, or three women. And he's got to nurture children from past marriages and all that at a distance. You know what? Those kind of entanglements bring distractions from a man in ministry. And they bring conflict in his present situation. And they require him to have detailed and repeated interaction with a woman who is not God joined to himself. And so thus he would not be a one-woman man. I think those kind of things clarify that a lot. So who would qualify? A man who is married only in a God-joined marriage and faithful to her and trustworthy. That's the ideal. And that eliminates this reproach of an ex-wife and all these other children and all of that. And he can clearly teach God's standard on marriage. A man who's separated from all unholy relationships. You know, maybe there was divorce in his past, but he has solid experience in moral faithfulness. He's not a ladies' man. He's not having tangles mentioned above. Now, here's a warning. Maybe if somebody was married to someone he had no right to, and he's separated from that marriage, he might be wide open for intense moral temptation. It might be wise not to choose him as an elder. But the point I'm saying is he must be a one-woman man, in other words, committed to marriage to only a woman that is God joined to him. So summary, what do we say? He's disqualified by two basic areas. Struggles regarding moral purity and entanglements from the past that require repeated involvement with more than one woman. Now, what about church history? Church history in the New Testament era, Paul is a significant interpreter of Jesus' teaching. He was even closer to Christ in culture and language than the church fathers. He spoke Aramaic, we know that from the book of Acts, and he also spoke contemporary Greek. He was educated as a Palestinian Jew. He's authoritative as an apostle, and he attributes his teaching to Jesus, 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 to 11. But he uses his own words, and that enables us to understand Jesus' words correctly. Paul gives no exception in addition to porneia for divorce, and he prohibits remarriage after divorce. And then Paul's teaching regarding elders and the requirements for elders gives additional understanding and insight regarding God's standard for man-woman relationships. What about the early church? There are repeated references to remarriage with absolute prohibitions. Even so, most of the comments apparently use Matthew. And no appeal is made in Matthew 19, verse 9 for a remarriage exception. Rarely any appeal to 1 Corinthians 7:15. Apparently there was one case in 400 years and then waited another 400 years for the next. I'm just taking that from someone who studied that detail. In other words, the church in the midst of a heathen world did not construe Paul's words in the way it's done today. The Council of Arles, canon number 10, a husband whose wife was guilty of adultery was forbidden to remarry as long as she was still alive, and thus you see the innocent party, supposedly, was forbidden remarriage. That council was in 314 AD. The early church rejected arguments that filled today's churches with adulterous marriages, and they were in the midst of a dark culture like we are. Well, the compromise began. Origen, you can read about him, around 247 AD, refers to church leaders making allowances for remarriage when the husband was still living, and he uses this terminology, contrary to Scripture. Doesn't that fit how things are done? Well, we know what it says, but they're doing this contrary to Scripture. Augustine, he lived around 400 AD. He wrote two treatises on marriage, the good of marriage, and also adulterous marriages. He made an interesting comment about compromise and how terrible compromise is. He said, "The notion that adulterous marriage after divorce is better than open fornication was the position that bishops had already taken. Choosing the lesser of two evils always results in more or more evil choices, since there's always a greater evil." That's a good comment. You see, if you choose the lesser of two evils, so you choose this evil. And then what else do you have? Next choice comes along, there's another lesser of two evils because there's more and more evil. He denied the right of the innocent party to remarry and regarded 1 Corinthians 7, verses 10 and 11, as explicit proof, and it was an inspired commentary on Jesus' teaching in Matthew 19. And Augustine responds to the fictional death view. Now, the fictional death view runs like this. Well, in the Old Testament, if somebody was guilty of adultery, they were executed. So therefore, today, if your spouse is guilty of adultery, and we don't execute them, well, in God's view, they're already dead, and therefore, you're free to remarry. That's the fictional death view. I mean, you'd be amazed there are people who hold that view. You know, a person is free to remarry if the person that committed adultery is dead and their body is in the grave. And you can see that back there in the days of Augustine, he was responding to these kind of things, the kind of things that we respond to today. There was this certain Pollentius was contesting the practice of the church. He was trying to justify full divorce and remarriage by considering the adulterous spouse as good as dead, and then the innocent party could remarry, according to 1 Corinthians 7:39. And you see, spouses could free themselves from unwanted marriages by committing adultery. And Augustine said that a person is free to remarry if his spouse departs from the body. Well, Augustine addressed the issue of when the wife ceases to be the wife of a husband. Quote, "The woman begins to be the wife of no later husband unless she has ceased to be the wife of her former one. But she will cease to be the wife of the former one if he should die, and not if he should commit fornication. As a consequence, a spouse is lawfully put away because of fornication, but the bond of chastity remains. For this reason, whoever marries a woman who has been put away, even for the reason of fornication, incurs the guilt of adultery." End of quote. And you see, the above quote shows that remarriage, that a new marriage, real marriage, is actually impossible. And Augustine responds to a complaint that most can't live singly in sexual restraint. He says, "We can't pervert Christ's gospel on their account because innumerable cases will arise. A wife suffering from chronic disease that prohibits relations, separations due to captivity or calamity, along with the knowledge that the spouse still lives." Think about the persecuted church in Romania or Russia, and a wife is at home and her husband is carried off and he's off in that prison for 20 years. What do we say has to happen for her? She has to remain single, doesn't she? She knows he's there, but then we come to the Reformed tradition. The Reformed tradition in church history allows for divorce and remarriage for both adultery and desertion. The sources of this view, Martin Luther. Martin Luther allowed divorce and remarriage for adultery and desertion. You can see a book that he wrote called the Babylonian captivity. And notice what Martin Luther did. He included as desertion their refusal to meet the spouse's sexual needs. Now, isn't it interesting how that once you go down a path, you start enlarging it to suit yourself? Let me just read a quote here because it comes from The Estate of Marriage. This is quoting from Martin Luther. It was written in 1522 and translated by a fellow named Walter Brandt. Quote, "In the case of adultery, Christ permits the divorce of a husband and wife so that the innocent person may remarry." Now you notice, that is just simply an assertion on Luther's part. Continuing quote, "The temporal sword and government should therefore still put adulterers to death, for whoever commits adultery has in fact himself already departed and is considered as one dead. Therefore the other, the innocent party, may remarry just as though his spouse had died, if it is his intention to insist on his rights and not show mercy to the guilty party." Quote. Now, I want to just make a note here. Being as good as dead depends on whether the innocent party decides not to show mercy. Here's some more. Desertion. Quote. "One of the parties deprives and avoids the other, refusing to fulfill the conjugal duty or to live with the other person. For example, one finds many a stubborn wife like that who will not give in and who cares not a whit whether her husband falls into the sin of unchastity 10 times over. Here it is time for the husband to say, 'If you will not, another will. The maid will come if the wife will not.' Only first the husband should admonish and warn his wife 2 or 3 times and let the situation be known to others so that her stubbornness becomes a matter of common knowledge and is rebuked before the congregation if she still refuses. Get rid of her. Take an Esther and let Vashti go as King Ahasuerus did." End of quote. That's Martin Luther for you. Now, desertion problem. If 1 Corinthians 7:15 would provide desertion exception, it would be only for the case of the believer who's been deserted by an unbeliever. It would not permit a professing believer to remarry when his believing wife departs from him because of his abusing her. John Calvin claimed that adultery dissolved the marriage bond. Desertion by an unbelieving spouse was viewed as divorcing God, thus breaking the marriage bond. You see this gobbledygook. Hence, adultery and desertion freed the innocent party to remarry. And John Calvin was instrumental and influential in formulating the marriage ordinances of Geneva, Switzerland. They were locally implemented in Geneva. The foundation here is they denied that the marriage bond was unbreakable. Now, the Westminster Confession, 1646, allows divorce and remarriage for both adultery and desertion. And I want to read you a quote here because it's just interesting in what it says about the situation. Quote, "In the case of adultery after marriage, it is lawful for the innocent party to sue out a divorce and after the divorce to marry another as if the offending party were dead." End of quote. You see this legal fiction dead view. Second quote, "Although the corruption of man be such as is apt to study arguments, unduly to put asunder those whom God hath joined together in marriage, yet nothing but adultery or such willful desertion as can no way be remedied by the church or civil magistrate is cause sufficient of dissolving the bond of marriage, wherein a public and orderly course of proceeding is to be observed, and the persons concerned in it not left to their own wills and discretion in their own case." End of quote. In other words, it's not really that the adultery or the desertion dissolved the marriage, but if the person says, "You know, I don't like what my spouse did," and I get the magistrate together and we get all this procedure, and then that dissolves it. Notice how this became instituted broadly as a matter of faith. This is in the Westminster Confession. "The Reformed tradition promotes the absurd legal fiction of death where the adulterer or deserter is regarded as dead." Now, this is extrapolated from the Old Testament, where the adulterer, of course, was executed. You know, calling them dead doesn't make them dead. I like the riddle that says this. If you call a tail a leg, how many legs does a sheep have? I love asking people that question. And if you don't prime them with this kind of thing, many times people say 5. And the answer is, calling it a leg doesn't make it a leg. It still has 4. But that's what these people do. They call it a leg when it isn't a leg. And you see the logical absurdity of claiming the innocent party is free to marry and the guilty party is not. Wait a minute. The only reason an innocent party can remarry is if the marriage is dissolved. And if the marriage is dissolved, both parties could remarry. Now, the clear implications of the writer's understanding of this marriage bond. The implications were that adultery did not dissolve the marriage, and mutual consent didn't dissolve the marriage because you had to go through this certain procedure with the magistrate and with the public and all of that. Marriage is dissolved by public legal means at the request of the injured party, and therefore the reformed view degenerates into merely being the decision of the wronged party that dissolves the marriage. Notice how you have a progression of error here. The followers claim that adultery dissolves the marriage. In fact, George Whitefield, in a sermon where he preached Christ the believer's husband, here's a quote, "Adultery is an iniquity to be punished by the earthly judges. It dissolves the marriage relation." Interesting. You know, when you start preaching false doctrine, it permeates the society. Just like that leaven hid in three measures of meal permeates the whole. William Heth made this comment. He says, "As far as I am aware, the early Greek-speaking fathers never discuss or debate the question of what the exception clause qualifies." And he refers to a certain author, and he says, "He seems to be the first person in the history of the church to appeal to a particular understanding of the syntax of Matthew 19:9 to justify remarriage after divorce for adultery." You see, the adultery delusion theory is only a theory, and it's false. Scripture nowhere says this. It's actually speculation beyond what Scripture actually says dissolves a marriage. Romans 7, verses 2 and 3 is proof that adultery does not dissolve the marriage. You know, if a woman is under the law of her husband, and if she goes out and is joined to another man, she'll be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, then she's no longer an adulteress. You see, the adultery didn't dissolve the marriage, but the death of her husband dissolved the marriage. 1 Corinthians 7:39 explicitly gives physical death of a spouse as license to remarry. And there's a practical absurdity, of course. If adultery dissolved the marriage, there's a lot of people who are unmarried and don't even know it. And furthermore, claiming that adultery dissolves the marriage runs counter to Christian forgiveness and restitution. You know, if adultery dissolved the marriage, restitution and continuation would be impossible. You'd have to go get remarried and say, "Well, my spouse committed adultery, we're getting remarried now because the marriage was dissolved." And this leads to perversion of existing marriages. You know, people unhappy in a marriage could use it as an escape, and the innocent supposed party could refuse conjugal obligations and drive an unwanted spouse into seeking a stranger, and they could actually end up rejoicing that their spouse was wayward, and it would shut the door to reconciliation and dangles the prospect of remarriage. I believe that this view is motivated by a misplaced desire to extend compassion to those whose marriage has shipwrecked. But remember, true compassion will always align itself with what God says. And in that regard, I want you to turn to 1 John chapter 5, verse 2. Sometimes people have the idea, "Well, I just love this person so much, I could never say these things." Let's look at 1 John chapter 5, verse 2. It says, "By this we know that we love the children of God when we love God and keep His commandments." A lot of people don't keep the commandments of God and they think they love the children of God, and it's not true. If you love the children of God, the way you can tell for sure is if you love God and keep His commandments. You know, the most loving thing you can ever do for a person is to help them prepare for eternity. An implementation of this will result in difficult circumstances, but so will other of God's commandments regarding murder, theft, dishonesty. The issue is whether we prefer our own authority or whether we prefer Christ's authority. Well, what were the consequences of the Reformers' errors? It undermined marriage and family stability in the Protestant. And this began happening in the Reformers' lifetime. Calvin approved of the divorce and remarriage of a fellow named Galeazzo Caracciolo. He had fled to Geneva, and he had deserted a wife and children in Italy who wanted to remain Catholic. And Calvin gave permission to remarry because she refused to join him. Now notice how Calvin has inverted the text here. He gave permission for a believer to desert an unbeliever. Now, Calvin and Luther wanted to restrict remarriages to the innocent party, but this turned out to be impossible almost immediately. You can see why that is. And I believe the explosion of divorce in the 20th century began with the Protestant Reformation. You know what? Compromise with the truth always progresses to the worst. The early exceptions with Calvin and Luther, are institutionalized as matters of faith in the Westminster Confession. And adultery as grounds for divorce and remarriage in the Westminster Confession has subsequently been carried further to say that adultery actually dissolves the marriage. In fact, it's interesting that Luther and Calvin said the same thing, but then you find it institutionalized later on in the Westminster Confession. The question we need to ask ourselves is, do we learn from history? At the earlier stages in church history, there was a strong stance against no remarriage if there's been divorce. And later, there's a modification to accommodate people's lifestyle.